This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday. Time to talk about your health. And this just in, literally within the last 5 minutes, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved that breakthrough drug for pancreatic cancer that we've been talking about here. It's called daraxonrasib, and it is slated to completely transform pancreatic cancer care. So the question will be, will that speed things along for us here in Canada? Also, as you heard in Jeremy's news, a 64-year-old Quebec man has become the first patient in North America to receive a regenerated liver thanks to a breakthrough technology that could make dozens of additional livers available for transplant. And it was regenerated by a new machine that was used for the first time in Montreal's CHUM, which is the Centre Hospitalier de l'Université de Montréal. And we have yet another set of numbers that confirm the dangers of e-scooters. This from the Canadian Institute for Health Information says hospitalizations for both children and adults rose by almost 40% just in the last year. And later in the show, we will have some numbers from police on that crackdown on micro-mobility devices, including those scooters, which just ended on Monday. Now, we'll talk about the medical side of that here. South of the border, Pennsylvania reported two deaths from measles. It's the first deaths in the United States this year. The people involved were unvaccinated, not surprisingly. And it comes as there's a warning about measles exposure in one of the hospitals here in the GTA just from this morning. And also, the Ontario nursing regulator is targeting questionable practices by medical spas offering Botox and other injections. And I have to say, this is something that I flagged in a series. It had to be at least 15 years ago. So we'll see if consumers will be better protected this time around. And I also want to talk about those new personalized mRNA cancer vaccines. We talked about them last week, but I have a bunch of questions. So I, assuming that our audience has some questions as well, 866-740-4740-416-360-0740.
Now time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Malcolm Moore, who is a medical oncologist at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, former head of BC Cancer, and Fahad Razak, Dr. Fahad Razak, general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto. Thank you, guys. Let's start, Fahad, with this just in, that the FDA approved daraxonrasib for pancreatic cancer. How will that affect us here?
Well, we knew this would happen. I mean, the magnitude of the benefit, it was clear this drug was going to be approved, and it's always approved first in the U.S. What we still don't know is how long will it be before it's submitted in Canada and approved, because some of the delays, honestly, in Canada are just that the companies submit in the U.S. and Europe first. So the two big questions for us and for our patients are, when does it come in Canada? And just as importantly, how much is this going to cost? Because a lot of these breakthrough drugs, have been in the range of 10 to 15,000 US a month. And I have not heard any information yet about how much the company is going to be charging. But it is, there's no question that this is the most significant breakthrough in pancreatic cancer treatment in the last 25 years. And this was tested, as we've talked about, in very advanced cases of pancreatic cancer. And the real hope is that if you treat earlier in the disease, the magnitude of the benefit may be greater. We may even be able to improve the cure rate for patients after they have surgery. So I think there's a lot of energy in the pancreatic cancer treatment field. At the moment, it's mixed with a little bit of frustration that the availability of this drug is limited, but that will certainly change fairly quickly.
Well, yeah, it's interesting you say that. Just this week, I was talking to somebody about one of their relatives who had just been diagnosed with stage four, and this person had the experience, was hoping to go to the States to get into a clinical trial there and just missed the cutoff. I don't know why. So, you know, it already hits home because patients are already aware of this, and I can just imagine the frustration if they don't have access.
Yeah, there's no question that some patients are going to Vermont and other states where they can get into clinical trials. But honestly, that's less than ideal. If you're sick with pancreatic cancer, you live in Peterborough, you don't really want to have to go to Vermont to get your cancer treatment. So I know a lot of people in Canada are working actively to get better access to this drug. The other maybe positive thing is, there are a lot of other drugs in development that are very similar to this. So I think the access through clinical trials, it already exists in Canada to some of these drugs, and that's only going to increase over the next few months.
There are clinical trials that are going to start here. When will that happen?
You know, I can't honestly give you an accurate figure. There are trials of this drug, daroxonrasib, which is easy for me to say.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of other drugs that work in a very similar manner that are currently in clinical trials at Princess Margaret and I'm sure other big cancer centers. And at the present time, that is a source of access for some patients.
Okay, let's go to Fahad. Fahad? Do we have you now?
Yeah, can you hear me okay now?
Yes, we can hear you okay now. What do you make of this regenerative liver transplant, the first in North America?
Yeah, so background for this is a lot of patients who want to donate organs, a lot of us are organ donors or have indicated we want to be, we can't end up using the organs because of various reasons. We worry about the organ, we say viability, meaning that maybe the patient's been sick enough that we're wondering if that organ, a heart, a kidney, a liver, is going to be able to work in a new person. And sometimes it's the transportation time and other factors. So we end up not using organs often, which maybe could have been viable. This is critical in that it's starting to show a number of important strategies. First, they've developed something that they run through the organ, like a perfusion liquid, that improves the ability of the organ to recover, even if there's some small level of damage from the patient being very sick in the last few days of life or the process of the transport. So they do that. They enhance the ability of the organ, the liver in this case, to recover a bit. Then they test it in a system where they run normal blood through it and they say, is it doing the thing that a healthy functioning liver should be able to do? Is it doing that properly? So they're looking at clearance of toxins and other things. So those two steps together mean that organs that otherwise, in this case, a liver, may have been discarded because, you know, the surgeons are too worried. Putting someone through an organ transplant surgery is a huge surgery. You don't want to do it unless you think that organ is going to survive in the patient. The patient's going to be able to survive and the organ's going to work. They now have these steps that are greatly increasing the chance that that organ is going to successfully be transplanted. So what does it mean for, you know, your listeners or a patient? It means that given that organ supply is always lower than the number of patients who could benefit from an organ, there's always people waiting. This kind of technology now could start to greatly increase the number of organs that are transferred. So I think overall we're talking about a really good news story and really kind of very advanced, almost sci-fi like technology, like very exciting technology on two fronts to do it.
My understanding is that the doctor responsible for this, he was just kind of fiddling around with the machine. Is that right?
I mean, I have to say so much of great medical innovation comes from the people who are doing, you know, in this case, we have surgeons who are day in and day out doing the transplants. They're seeing examples where, we're not transplanting. I really think that organ could have worked. Or an example where you do a transplant and then the organ fails, which is catastrophic for the recipient and catastrophic for the donor and their family. And so, you know, I think it's often that's where the innovation comes from. It's people who are doing the work every day and wondering, could we do this a little bit better? I think it's a great story.
Do you know how many people are on the wait list for a liver transplant?
I don't know specifically for a liver transplant, but I can say I have a lot of patients who have terminal illness, liver disease, kidney disease. There, many of them are waiting. This is a story we see on the wards all the time. We're admitting patients with complications from a failing organ who are on that list who are waiting. I can think of many examples. I'm going on clinical service again tomorrow at St. Mike's for the next week, and I was just on a couple of weeks ago. I can think of many examples every week I'm on where you're seeing patients suffering, having complications because they are now at that terminal end stage phase of organ failure.
Malcolm, what are the implications for people with either liver cancer or cancer that's metastasized to the liver?
You know, that's a good question. What's happening is that we're expanding the indications for liver transplant
in the presence of cancer, but
the present time is just limited by the availability of organs. And the other point I'd sort of make as a follow-on from Fahad is that the longer you have to wait for an organ, the sicker people get. And about in Ontario, I think, or in Canada, about 30% of the people on the transplant list die still on the transplant list waiting for an organ. So anything that accelerates the number of organs, people get transplanted earlier, they're going to do better.
Do you have any of these machines?
Me personally?
Not personally, no. But
we have UHN has probably one of the most sophisticated transplant programs in the world. And so my guess would be the answer is yes.
That's a guess, though, because this came out of Quebec. Any surprise that this came out of Quebec?
No, I mean, you know, transplantation is a very active field. It tends to be centralized to larger institutions. You don't have community hospitals doing organ transplants. And so these transplant programs, whether it be in Montreal or Toronto or Vancouver, are very sophisticated, well-running operations, and they're quite integrated. These groups work together in terms of organ availability and things like that. So it is, as Fahad said, overall, this is a very good news story.
Okay. Talk about a not good news story that we've talked about before, and that is the dangers of e-scooters. And there's yet another study that shows a 40% increase in hospitalizations in 1 year alone, Fahad. That's a lot.
It's a lot. It's the worst kind of injuries. It is often brain injury, concussions, it's fractures. It disproportionately affects younger people. It's kids who have no business being on a motorized vehicle going extremely fast. Many of these people are not wearing helmets. I don't know why there is a perception that a scooter doesn't require a helmet, but a bicycle should. The scooters are going faster often than the bicycles. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Honestly, it feels like a bit of a plague of locusts on downtown city streets now to see these scooters zipping in and out. And my colleagues in the emergency room are telling me what this study shows. They are seeing a huge rise in injuries. And I feel like the regulators have fallen behind here. They've fallen asleep on the job. This has to be more tightly regulated for pedestrian safety, for the people who are being hit by scooters, and for the people who are using the scooters. This has not made transportation better, and it has certainly not made safety better. This is a problem on multiple fronts.
Yeah, but they're illegal already. It might be an enforcement problem. You know, after we finish our chat here, I'm going to be talking to the cops because they had a 2-week blitz. But just anecdotally, Fahad, did you see any change in the last 2 weeks?
Anecdotally, I have not. I'm a stats guy, so show me the data. If you can show me things dipped in the last 2 weeks, I'll say great job. This is an area where, there's a lot of things in society like this where you have rules and then either it's the regulation side or the enforcement side. This one, I think your listeners and anyone who's been downtown or on any city street will know that whatever the gap is, the end result is these things are zipping in and out of traffic and onto sidewalks and onto pedestrians and whatever. And again, I want to emphasize, I'm not just saying this as a pedestrian. I'm a cyclist. I work at a hospital. This is a problem across multiple fronts that's happening now.
Yeah. I'm going to ask about something perhaps not quite as serious, Malcolm, and I think it's in some ways related to virtual medicine, which can be very good for some things. So the nursing regulator is cracking down, maybe, on a bunch of these medical spas. That medical spa thing has exploded. They inject Botox and other cosmetics, and they bill themselves things like master injector, which is not a medical designation. And I remember years ago when this first started to float up, there were doctors who were, they were the medical directors, but they were far away and maybe on Zoom. And that's the case now with nurses, and who knows who is doing these injections, presumably people who are, you know, aestheticians or something.
Yeah, so it's an interesting issue, and I think even if you use the word medical, if someone hears the word medical something, they assume that the regulations and the safety rules around medical services that exist in Ontario exist for these organizations. And I think that may not be the case. So obviously hospitals, facilities providing that kind of healthcare, they're accredited, they're supervised, the physicians who work there are regulated, the nurses are regulated. But then you're moving into this fuzzy area where it's a quasi-medical procedure given by people who may be doctors or nurses or may not be. And I think there's just a general lack of regulations, and sometimes bad things can happen. I mean, you know, some years ago, a woman died at one of these clinics, and I think it comes back to, it's the same thing almost as the e-scooters, is what responsibility does society have to regulate things to protect the public? And I think In the so-called medical spa services, you know, when does a spa that gives you massages move into medical services that need to be more closely regulated? It's complicated, but I think it's clear that what's going on in some of these places, it's very much let the buyer beware.
Well, exactly. I mean, people should be checking who is there and what happens if something goes wrong. But Fahad, I mean, the ethical, like, it's unclear if even in the so-called tougher regulations by the nursing regulators, if they have anything to say about these off-site medical directors who presumably, like, they aren't going to be there if something bad happens.
Yeah, they're not in the room, but they are lending the credibility of their official clinical status to the fact that this procedure is happening. So you can see it's very deceptive for the public, right? And this is where the regulators have a role. Look, when I get onto an airplane, my expectation is that a regulator provides oversight to the people maintaining that plane and the people flying that plane in a way that I, a physician who has zero training in that thing, can feel that I am safe. right? And this is where I believe there's a very good analogy to these kinds of clinics, which is the general public, I don't believe it is their job to know the nuances of vetting, of clinical expertise and oversight. That is the job of government, of regulators, of other people. And it is an example where I think these clinics, I am admitting patients. It's interesting with the e-scooter example because the Canadian Institute for Health Information has now clearly tracked it and shown harm. I'd love for them to look at what is resulting from these clinics, because I can tell you anecdotally, I am admitting patients to hospital with infections and other complications who get cosmetic procedures. And often when I ask where they're getting it, it's not through the highly trained plastic surgeon. They are going to these clinics and getting things done, or sometimes they're going abroad. Now, that is not a Canadian government problem, but they are going abroad to get it done because it's cheaper. The other thing I'll say is there was a Globe and Mail article in the last couple of weeks that has also showed that increasingly young people are taking serious loans to get these procedures done, right? With extraordinarily high, like they're paying credit card level interest rates to go get a Botox filler or whatever procedure that they're having done. So they're people are spending enormous amounts of money they don't have. They're getting these done by people who are not trained to do it or providing oversight. And I and other clinicians are seeing the complications downstream as they end up in hospital, some of them with complications from these procedures.
Yeah, and a lot of them look really bizarre, overfilled. Yeah. I gather from social media that that's going out of fashion. I hope so. But you see these 25-year-olds that are, I mean, I don't know. But
when did it become attractive that faces don't move anymore? It's like it's just frozen into place.
What about cheekbones? we have a few minutes left, and I have a question about those personalized mRNA vaccines, Malcolm. And I know that in the trial that everybody got so excited about, they were given along with immunotherapy. So how do you tease out a result from immunotherapy and versus this vaccine?
Well, that's a good question. I guess just to make a couple of points here, we've talked about before the fact that, you know, there may be 20,000 cases of colon cancer in Canada a year, but they're all genetically different and to some degree unique. And so as we've understood that, the treatments are becoming more personalized. And the ultimate personalized treatment is where you actually take the tumor, you understand what antigens, what proteins are on the cancer, what mutations occur in the cancer, and you then develop a vaccine which is very personalized for that individual. And we can use those for diagnosis. We can use these tests for diagnosis to see if the cancers come back. And now we're starting to see that this will create a therapy. And the idea of giving it with when you give immunotherapy, fundamentally what you're trying to do is stimulate your own body's immune system to fight the cancer. So it has to recognize the cancer. It has to fight the cancer. So it makes sense to combine these sorts of drugs with the vaccines because the vaccines target the cancer, but you may need the help of your own immune system to actually help the vaccine fight the cancer. So whether it's 60% the vaccine, 40% the immunotherapy, ultimately it doesn't matter. It's what's the result for the patients. And this work has been going on for a long time, I would say. But as the understanding of cancer has improved and the technology has improved, these vaccines are getting much, much better.
So how transformative do you think this new technology will be?
Well, I think this is the way the field is going. You know, if you look back to 10 or 20 years ago, it was basically everybody with colon, breast, pancreas, whatever, gets similar treatments based on, you know, what seems to work best. Now it's much more individualized, where we can't really tell you what your treatment is till we understand what the specific features of your cancer is. So this whole field of personalized medicine and personalized immunotherapy is really, it is where the field is going, and it is quite transformative, I think.
Okay.
It's a very exciting time in cancer treatment.
On that very positive note, we're going to wrap things up. Thank you so much, Dr. Malcolm Moore, Dr. Fahad Razak, and we will talk again soon. Bye-bye.
See you later. Take care. Thanks.
Okay, we're taking a break. And as promised, when we come back, we're going to get the numbers on that micromobility device crackdown. Did it work? When we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Okay, people, I have a question for you. Did you notice any change on our roads during the police crackdown on e-scooters and e-bikes? So the numbers to call for that, 866-744-7440-416-360-0740. Well, that blitz just ended on Monday, and Sergeant Murray Campbell of Toronto Police Traffic Services joins me now with some numbers. Sergeant, thank you so much.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having us.
Okay, so what were the results of this crackdown?
So the Toronto Police Service, although we only issued 324 tickets and warnings, these are written warnings, we engage a much larger volume of people that are operating bicycles, micromobility devices, e-kick scooters, e-bikes, and all sorts of different mobility devices across the city. Our campaign was not based solely on the numbers, but is also a very robust education campaign that we partnered with the City of Toronto to get the word out there, to start the conversations happening, because we understand that the rules around who can ride these, where they can be ridden, and when are very confusing.
Right. My understanding is that they're illegal here in Toronto.
So an e-bike is not illegal. But there are certain restrictions on what type of e-bike, what modifications you can make, and where they can be ridden. But the e-kick scooters, 100%, they are not allowed to be ridden in any public spaces within the City of Toronto.
Okay. And, you know, I see them all the time. We just quoted, there have been multiple reports on the damage they cause, and one just yesterday from the Canadian Institute of Health Information. And in 1 year alone, there was a 40% increase in hospitalization, mostly kids, resulting from the injuries. Now, first of all, do you have any insight about why it had gone up so much in 1 year alone?
Well, I'm imagining that the increase in ridership has a great portion to that. These are great mobility devices if used properly by the right people. Unfortunately, this is a pilot program that was put on by the province of Ontario, which allowed municipalities or cities to opt in or to not opt in to their use. These small e-kick scooters, they're stand-upon devices that have a high center of gravity and very small wheels, not very congruent to safe operation within the City of Toronto. As we know, we have streetcar tracks, lots of pedestrians, lots of potholes, unfortunately. They are not safe to be operated here, and the city recognized that, and that's why they decided not to opt into this program.
Okay, so if your goal wasn't just issuing those tickets and warnings, tell me something about presumably how, if you stopped some of these teenagers on these scooters, how was your message received?
Well, I can tell you that it's not just teenagers that we're stopping. There are people of all ages that are using these devices. These devices have a use in a certain setting. And unfortunately, when it's not known out there and the people that are not taking the time to review what is allowed and what isn't allowed, simply driving it across one street from one municipality to another municipality could change the lawfulness of it. A lot of people just don't understand that. They see that everybody else is using them, so they figure it must be all right, so I'm going to use it as well.
But again, do you have any insight in how those messages were received? Because you're saying a lot of this is the education piece.
Yes. So a lot of it, specifically to kick scooters, was received with shock that they didn't know that they were not allowed to be operated here. It takes a little bit of time, a little bit of digging to find out what the City of Toronto has allowed and where they have allowed it. Different devices are allowed in different areas. And this is why we started this campaign, to get the people talking about it and prompt people to start looking at what is allowed and what isn't allowed.
And
an awful lot of these devices we found had been modified. And that was really, really concerning to us.
Okay, yes, especially the e-bikes, and they cause all those fires as well. But again, so when you delivered this message, did the people seem to care? Or it's like, hey, I'm just going to do what I'm going to do.
I would say it's a bit of both. We've engaged with an awful lot of people, and there's an awful lot of people that was not aware. And then people that are aware are going to maybe get off their kick scooter, walk around the corner away from us, and jump back on again. And that's unfortunate, because that puts themselves and others at risk in the city.
Okay. And you know, is there a threat? Do you think that it would be appropriate to give people a real penalty as a deterrent?
That is what we did. We laid 324 tickets on people where appropriate. An awful lot of our interactions started with operator behavior. So people that were not stopping at stop signs, people that were operating on sidewalks within crosswalks, people that were putting others at risk. Those were our main focus, and those are the people that garnered the attention and the ticket issuance at this stage.
Was the ticket?
It all depends on what the offense is. A red light ticket is the same cost as if you were driving through a red light in your car, which can be hundreds of dollars.
Uh-huh. And going through a stop sign?
$110.
Okay. And
that's a big deterrent.
And how do you collect that, given that they don't have licenses on these things?
It's up to the province and the city to collect those things. A lot of people do have licenses that are operating these things, and be collected in the same manner as any other ticket issued by the province.
Okay, well, there are different issues with both those devices. And the e-bikes can be a lot worse. That, as you said, they're modified, they cause fires, and they have no place in a bike lane because they're big electrical devices. Do you need more legal backup on those things?
I don't know if we need more legal backup. We need more education, more buy-in to the safety risks that they're posing. There are different types of e-bikes, ones that can be operated as an electric-assisted bicycle, and they can be operated within bike lanes, where the throttle-only ones you see that look like little scooters or motorcycles, those ones are the ones that are bigger, heavier, and pose a greater risk.
And do people understand that there's a threshold for the weight of them?
Everybody should understand what is allowed. That being said, it is not always followed. And that can be shown by the number of tickets that we did actually issue. Some of these are electric motorcycles. The province has made this a temporary pilot program, and they'll be looking at the results of it. And without these conversations, the feedback to the province saying what is safe and what isn't safe won't be received. So we wanted to start that conversation.
And again, one of the thoughts about the e-bikes is at the end of the day, a lot of them are commercial vehicles. And I know when I'm driving, the bike lane next to me is, you know, it's like the special Uber Eats lane. So Is there anything that you would like to see in terms of regulating that?
Well, absolutely. Regulation starts, like I said, with an education. If everybody sees everybody else doing it, they're just going to follow along. Until we stop, break that chain, we can't effectively regulate it on behalf of the province and the city.
Okay. Anything else you want to leave us with?
We live, work, and all travel around the city of Toronto all together. It's a shared responsibility for everybody's safety that's out there. It is not an individual. It's the individual choice that they want to make it safer for everybody. And the Toronto Police encourages everybody to do so.
Okay. Sergeant Campbell, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for spreading the word.
Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, people, we are taking a break. And when we come back, Mayor Andrea Horvath of Hamilton.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, there is no question that, at least in the short term, the retaliatory tariffs announced Monday will add more pain to one of the hardest hit areas, Hamilton. Now, the government also announced at the same time a relief package, but small business advocates say that that will not help most small businesses. So what does the mayor of Hamilton say? Andrea Horvath joins me now. Mayor Horvath, thanks so much for being with us.
It's always my pleasure, and it's nice to see you again. It's been a little bit.
It's been a little bit. Now, just as a note, I have to say, watching you standing next to the premier on Monday, I mean, the shifting alliances of politics, because I remember some of many nasty things that he said about you specifically, and there you were kind of bolstering each other.
Well, fighting for my city is what I do now, Libby. I fight for my city. I used to fight for the people of the province, and now I fight for the people of Hamilton. And sometimes that fight means, making sure that we're getting everything we can from the federal and provincial governments, particularly in times like this, as I'm sure you can appreciate. It's going to be a tough time for Hamilton and Hamiltonians. And I reached out very quickly to both the Prime Minister and the Premier to start talking about what they can do to help our industries. And so that's a big part of the conversation that we're having right now is how do we, I think we're when this all started a while back, we were identified as the eighth most impacted in the country in terms of our economy when it comes to U.S. tariffs. And we're concerned.
Okay, yes. I mean, obviously, the steel industry hit hard. How will those retaliatory tariffs impact your people?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to identify that at this point, we are hearing a lot of support for the federal government's position. As you know, that means likely a lot more pain. You just kind of mentioned that for many industries, many companies here in Hamilton and across Canada. We'll see how bad that pain gets. I hope that the programs that have been announced are going to be helpful and that they're going to be easily accessible. And that's something that that's not under my control, but certainly something I'm advocating for on behalf of workers as well as on behalf of industries and companies. And it's the steel sector, but it's also, I mean, we have an agricultural sector, so food production, we have manufacturing, about 28,000 jobs in those sectors alone. And of course, then there's the knock-on impacts for example, our transportation industry and for our farmers, et cetera. So, yeah, I'm hopeful, but there's no doubt that retaliatory tariffs will increase the pain. Again, I think at this point it's pain that that people are prepared to deal with, knowing that the bigger pain would be losing our sovereignty, and nobody wants that.
Well, yes, it's incredible how much people support the Prime Minister's approach on this one. But I want to ask about the relief packages. They were just unveiled. Immediately after they were unveiled, the Canadian Federation of Independent Business said there are a host of small businesses that can't even apply, as far as they know. They called it a word salad of complicated programs administered by another word salad of agencies that most small businesses have never even heard of. Now, have you heard from Hamiltonians since that package was unveiled?
I have a somewhat, but not in great detail, and that's one of the things I'm hoping to do. That when the tariffs were first introduced, I don't even know, over a year ago now, it feels 2 years ago, right? I mean, it feels like it's that we've lived with it forever, but I held some roundtables to get exactly that, to get the input directly from people, industries, businesses impacted, because we are quite a diversified economy here in Hamilton. And so various sectors were being impacted in various ways. I'm looking to reconvene those conversations. And I'm also looking to work with our economic development team here in Hamilton to help facilitate or navigate through those word salads. And I think that that's something practical that we can do as a municipality, is to help with some navigation for those small businesses that don't have the capacity to, and don't have the experts and don't have the lawyers and are not going to be able to find the time while they're trying to survive to do that legwork themselves. And so these are conversations I'm having internally here at the city. We don't have a lot of financial capacity as cities to buffer the pain of a trade war, but certainly of a tariff war. But certainly, there are things we can do to try to, you know, help assist, facilitate businesses to access the programs that the other orders of government are bringing forward. And I would hope that we can do that for workers as well.
It seems like the barrier comes down to size. And a lot of small businesses are too small.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because, and you'll know this from our previous conversations in many years ago, but it's often said that small business is the backbone of our economy. Small business is the backbone of our economy. And so we need to be very thoughtful about that, because those small businesses, they have employees, and those employees are often like family. And so this is one of the things that I think we need to really take a pause to look at, because it's very difficult for a small business to lay off people that have worked with them for 10, 15, 20 years, in some cases much, much longer. I was at a company not too long ago in Hamilton. They were celebrating a milestone anniversary of 100 years, and many of their workers had been with them for 25, 35, 40 years. Having to lay off workers that are like your family is not only economically problematic for the workers and for the business, obviously, but it's also a very difficult thing emotionally and in terms of the well-being of the people that have to make those decisions. And so I think there's a lot we need to look at in terms of how do we bolster, how do we hold up the small businesses, because a lot of them also play key roles in the supply chain.
Okay, those programs, they're federal programs. What can the province do for you?
Well, I mean, this is, you were talking about my conversation with the premier on Monday, and they're also put together some plans for some support for workers, et cetera. And what my job is now, what the city's job is now, is to look at how we can, A, get feedback on possible amendments or gaps maybe that might be identified on the ground, and then advocate for those gaps to be narrowed or eliminated. The other thing would be to, as I said, help facilitate access to the programs, and the only way to do that is by listening to what the people impacted, the companies impacted, the workers impacted, the unions that are impacted, what they have to say, and then take on that advocacy role. So I think that there is a lot that the federal and provincial governments can do. The issue is ease of access clarity of the programs, as well as getting the money out the door as quickly as possible.
This morning, the mayor of Toronto, Olivia Chow, was all over a U.S. news media saying she supports Ontario cutting off electricity. Not that that is anywhere inside her jurisdiction. And even though that seems to be something that even the premier is climbing down from, because other provinces are not on side and the Americans can retaliate because they send us some electricity. Do you have is there anything that you think would be too much for us to do? Do you have a view of any of that?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we take a Team Canada approach. We have to be all in this together. And so having, disagreements between the provinces in terms of the path forward and being offside with what the federal government's desires are to address this situation is not going to be good. I've said from day one, Team Canada approach is the approach I want to take. And so I would rather have those players or those representatives or those orders of government having the conversations themselves in order to have a solidarity, if you will, to have solidarity and to have a common front of response that everybody can get behind. Because I don't think it serves anybody in Canada if we are going to be fragmented and fighting amongst ourselves as to the response. Because divide and conquer is an old tactic, but it's one that works every single time. So let's not let that happen, first and foremost. I would also say, though, that what I'm hearing from Canadians is that we have to fight fire with fire, that we have to be really prepared to fight and to fight in a way that is going to make it clear that we're never going to become anything but Canada, and we are never going to allow another country to tell us how to be Canada. And that's really, I think, the imperative that we all share as Canadians.
Okay. I'm hearing you say that you think you're best served by staying in your lane.
Well, you know, it's a respect thing as well. I don't want to be a person that puts out something and then that causes ripples that are damaging to our efforts to help Canada get through this. And so I don't know. I mean, I'm never, it's a funny thing. Stay in your lane. I'm a strong and fierce advocate, but I also want to be respectful of the Team Canada approach. And so within that frame, maybe that is staying in my lane, but it's also staying in a place where I don't inadvertently cause damage or cause trouble and let those folks who have the power to make those decisions do so. And I expect them to do so in the best interest of Canadians, as I think we all do.
It seems like a reasonable approach. And I have to note that back to Doug Ford, who was so fiery and using profanity on Monday. Well, he way backed off of that. He hasn't apologized, but he said, let's get back to the table. And personally, I'm pretty convinced that the professional people in part of this are probably have already been in touch with each other.
Yeah, I have to say I was kind of shocked about not so much about the premier's reaction, but it was in pretty bad taste and in pretty poor form to raise Rob Ford's name, frankly, with his brother. I mean, that's just, that is really low. It was a low blow. And so the premier reacting the way he did, I think, is not unexpected, because that just should never happen. That's not a dignified response from a world leader. It's not a dignified way to deal with others. It was pretty low. And again, that's up to Mr. Trump and President Trump in terms of how he deals with himself. But if you're gonna go low, you're gonna elicit responses, and that's, I guess, his jam. That's what he likes to do. But it's sometimes it's really hard when it's that personal of a thing to restrain yourself from responding. So I you know, I was there. I was there at that press conference. And so I was shocked myself when the reporter read out what had been posted on the, what is it, Truth Social or whatever the heck it's called. I never go on it myself, but it was, I was shocked myself that that was, that was done, that the actual president of the United States did something like that.
Okay, sorry. Well, I see we're out of time. I don't think anybody is expecting dignified comments from Donald Trump, but interesting to have your reaction about how that went down. And best of luck trying to help the businesses in your area. And I think that navigation piece is really important.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Libby. We're gonna work hard and do everything we can to get through this and get through it together.
Okay. Andrea Horvath, thanks. Mayor of Hamilton. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Libby Znaimer. Follow us on YouTube. Follow us on Instagram. I'll be back here tomorrow and we'll talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.